Welcome to State of the News. I'm Rick Hallett. Well, we begin the hour, as we do most weeks, with Metro News and our merry band of reporters from the WFPL newsroom, Gabe Bullard, Erica Peterson, Philip Bailey, and Devin Katayama joining us. Welcome, everyone.
Hello.
Thanks. Hi.
We'd also like to hear from you today. Call us at 502-814-TALK. That's 502-814-8255. Or toll free at 1-877-814-TALK, 877-814-8255. You can email us at news@wfpl.org. We're also on Twitter, WFPL News. And you can also visit us on Facebook. Gabe Bullard, let's start with you. Contract talks between the Louisville Orchestra management and the musicians have produced no deal after several months. And today, Mayor Fisher is getting involved.
Yeah, yesterday the mayor met with the management of the orchestra. He met with them around noon. He's meeting with them, with the musicians, in about an hour at his office. He's hoping to help them come to an agreement. Both sides have been open to talking with the mayor. They're working with the Louisville Labor Management Committee as well as the official mediators, trying to figure out how they can put together a contract for the next season.
Now, the orchestra, there was, I guess this is a national union or association that gave this unfair designation. What is that?
Yeah, it's an interesting breakdown of how the American Federation of Musicians covers the U.S. and Canada, but then there's a further breakdown on the local level, and then there's even that subgroup of orchestra musicians inside of that. But the National Union put the orchestra on its unfair list. They say that orchestra CEO Rob Berman had hinted that the orchestra could pursue outside musicians, possibly even non-union musicians, to play the season if they didn't have a contract in place. Berman says he never said that, that it was taken, that part of his testimony in court was taken out of context, and that that's not something that they had seriously considered. But no matter what, the AFM did put the orchestra on the unfair list. That means that any musician who's a member of the union who provides services for the orchestra will be punished. There are fines. It hurts their reputation. It could end a musician's career if they cross that line. The interesting thing about it is that it would have been possible. It seems like the management has said that it would have been possible to encourage a few musicians to come and rehearse and practice and prepare outside of the union. But the musicians, of course, say that's not really the case.
Now, you talked about who else is on this unfair list, and it's an interesting list. Right?
Yeah, there's an orchestra in suburban Dallas that's on the list for a similar sort of deal. Contract negotiations not really going right. And then also Mr. Wayne Newton is on the list as well. So, and you can get off the list essentially by putting together an agreement, by having a deal with the union, signing a new contract.
Is there any sense of optimism that you can tell that a deal is possible?
Well, even their mediator says both sides are very far apart. They're doing a lot of these meetings by phone at this point, according to the reports. The mayor's involvement may spur some sort of activity, but it's not yet clear. The core of the dispute is how big the orchestra needs to be and for how long it needs to be that size. The musicians say they've offered to knock the number down from 71 full-time musicians to 60, and instead of a 37-week season, a 35-week season. The management says that's not sustainable. They say that there are some musicians who don't play for that whole season, and so they've offered this tiered system where musicians would be in three different tiers, and those tiers would be signed to contracts, some as short as 10 weeks. That's been the offer that's put forward. The musicians have rejected that because they say 10 weeks of payment is not enough for a musician, that you're not going to get the best musicians that you can when they'll only be signed for 10 weeks at their normal pay rate.
So 2 months of performances have now been canceled. What will we be missing?
Well, there will be a few concerts. The Fanfara. Mm-hmm. I'm maybe pronouncing it wrong. That was supposed to start September 10th, and that has been canceled. And then there are a few other shows happening in September and October that won't play. There are six official orchestra concerts, but then the musicians say there are 17 performances that people could attend, some educational performances and whatnot, that now will not happen of the orchestra. So it would have been possible, according to the musicians, to see them 17 times in this space. That no longer will be possible.
Now, other organizations use the orchestra in performances, the opera, the ballet. What will they do?
Yeah, the ballet during this impasse decided and had communicated with the orchestra that they will use recorded music. You'll remember they, I believe, used some recorded music last year. These negotiations have been going on for a while, and so the ballet had already used some recorded music. For the Kentucky Opera, it's a different situation. A singer works better singing along, having a conductor, having live musicians. Mm-hmm. It's really difficult to have the opera perform without live musicians in the pit. And they always used orchestra musicians, but now they can't. The opera officials have promised that they will have a live performance for their season starting next month. It's not yet clear how that's going, though. The opera has reached out to the union. They are trying to get a few musicians signed on. The opera is not on this unfair list, so it should be okay if they can work out that deal. However, again, that seems pretty far apart, at least from the parties involved, from what they're saying.
Will this delay in the schedule affect the orchestra's bankruptcy emergence?
Rob Berman, the CEO, says it will not, that the plan essentially outlines what would happen if a labor contract weren't signed. There are other activities the opera does that don't, or not opera, the orchestra does, that don't involve the full orchestra playing or the orchestra playing at all. So those activities will continue in the meantime.
All right, Gabe, thank you. Let's turn now to Devin Katayama. Devin, you were front and center this week when arguments were held before the Kentucky Court of Appeals on a suit challenging the Jefferson County Public Schools student assignment plan. The argument, Teddy Gordon, the attorney making the argument on behalf of his plaintiffs, that students should be allowed to attend the school closest to their home.
Yeah, this case was difficult to follow at first. There's a lot of history in this case, a lot going back to the 70s. As people may know, in this county, since 2000, the federal mandate for busing, that, you know, bus students from segregation reasons, was lifted. And so the Jefferson County Public Schools has been operating under a 50%, 15% minority range, meaning you can't have minorities or 50% above a certain minority percentage and 15% below. And so that's how Jefferson County's been operating, which has been, it's come under a lot of scrutiny, especially lately. And so this court case was in response to 2010 circuit court case, which compared the word enroll versus attend. And the word attend was lifted in 2000 from legislation. So the debate earlier this week was about that word. And what we're going to hear right now is basically the argument that was before the court. And this is the Jefferson County Board Attorney Byron Lee.
It is the issue in this case. I believe that the circuit court got it right on page 8 of Judge Mays's opinion when he said plaintiffs are of the position that enroll and attend have the same meaning and may be used interchangeably. The school board argues that enroll and attendance are two separate words with different definitions and meaning, and it is erroneous to use the two words interchangeably. I think Judge Mays got that right. That is the question that's before the court.
Now, Lee had a point. This was the purpose of the court hearing. But what was interesting was that the judges kept coming back to the idea that the Jefferson County student assignment plan isn't working. Two judges, Judge Caperton and Judge Thompson, Kelly Thompson, were definitely peppering questions to Leet the whole time, very accusatory and questioning whether or not the Jefferson County Public School student assignment plan was working. Test scores are down, they mentioned. And then they also mentioned things like the Jefferson County website, public school website, used words interchangeably, the enroll versus attend. So that I found also really interesting. And at the end, it was very obvious that the way that's the judges were leaning towards. And the clip I'm going to play for you now is Teddy Gordon after the court hearing. And he's going to be responding to, you hear him say no to a response of whether or not he's seen a response like this in the court system so far.
Well, in actuality, it was the best rebuttal I ever made because I said that. A simple answer is no. But when I was at the Supreme Court of the United States, all of us could clearly tell the direction that the justice was asking the question. So there is precedent for it, but not to this degree. These three justices were very, very strong in their position to tell the school board that they have over-litigated this matter. They were not accepting any semantical difference that Sheila said between enroll and attend and to return to neighborhood school.
And I was reading an article, an op-ed opinion in the Courier today, and I think they made a good point. the judge's opinion on whether or not the student assignment plan is not really what the case was being heard of, what the case was about at that point. It was really about the word attend versus enroll. It'll be very interesting to see what they decide. They're expecting a decision within the next 4 to 6 weeks, so we'll wait for that.
And assuming there will be an appeal of this, this will go to the Kentucky Supreme Court.
It could. They have to ask the Kentucky Supreme Court whether or not they want to hear it, which could take 6 months to a year. So, I asked the JCPS board attorney, Lisa DiGiacco, the assistant attorney, whether this was likely to, see any changes in Jefferson County within the next year or so. And she said, no, definitely not, because of how long this might take.
Okay, thank you, Devin. We'll be following this as it goes on. Philip M. Bailey, let's turn to you. Another development. It seems like every Friday we have another development in the Judy Green removal case. Councilwoman Green is asking the Metro Council for a delay in her removal hearing for health reasons, and the council court that's been appointed pretty emphatically said no yesterday.
Yes, the council court, which will preside over the removal hearing of Councilman Green, voted unanimously 17-0 against her attorney's motion to delay the trial. Attorney Derwin Webb, who was representing Councilman Green, he was arguing that essentially they had provided the evidence in a signed affidavit from her physician, Dr. Wayne Gibson, that he presented that to the Metro Council, saying that he wanted to push the trial back by at least 30 days to give the councilman just time to recoup and give them time to reschedule the hearing. Council members seemed to not buy that that argument, but I think the clip we're about to play for you now is Attorney Webb making the argument that he's done this in good faith and that there have been some accusations that either he or Councilman Green were lying about her hospitalization.
I have done nothing and have done everything proper per the rules that this court adopted and have acted in good faith throughout this process. Everything done has been relevant and germane to the case you will hear and in some parts have already heard. Above all, I wanted to point out to the council members that are here, your colleague is sick. It's something that I have not made up, but she is sick, and we have documented proof to show that she is under a treating physician right now. So I challenge anyone in this court or in this room right now to show me anything that I have done since July 14th, when I actually came on this case, that is one, improper, two, inappropriate, or three, in bad faith.
Mr. Webb, I don't mean to interrupt you, but you're not on trial here now.
I am a lawyer, and I do want to handle certain things the appropriate and legal way. Because the rule, in my opinion, Rule 6, which you adopted on July 14th, has been satisfied and supporting documentation has been granted, I respectfully ask that you grant my motion for continuance, set it for an appropriate date, and have an opportunity for Dr. Green to get well and to be able to be at the proceedings.
And what you hear there is Councilman Kelly Downer, who's the chairman of the court, basically presiding over it. There was an exchange between him and Mr. Webb. There were many moments where this did actually get pretty tense. And the affidavit that Mr. Webb is talking about goes over a few things, but to document that Councilman Green has been hospitalized and she's in the care of a physician. But that affidavit was still very vague to council members and to those who were watching the proceedings. For example, the fifth part of the affidavit testifies that Councilman Green's present participation, quote, in any process that would create or involve undue stress. Many council members arguing that the removal trial itself is stressful. Mr. Webb was asked what was wrong with Councilman Green specifically and asked what hospital she was in. That's sort of, I think, this exchange we're about to play next between Mr. Webb and Jefferson County Attorney Michael Connell goes over that. I think that's why council members decided what they did.
You indicated, I think, that on August 14th that Ms. Green's husband, James, contacted you and said that Ms. Green was ill. Is that correct?
That's correct.
What did he tell you?
That is something I cannot release to here because those are medical things that I believe that you need to address with the acting physician.
On August 15th, I believe you said, did you speak with your client or her husband again who said she had been admitted to the hospital?
I spoke to my client's husband.
Okay, and what hospital was she admitted to?
That's something that you have to take up with the treating physician.
Okay, that leads me to the question I really want to get to is, do you believe and is it your position that it is the council court's obligation to go seek medical information from your client's treating physician in order to do their work here?
Well, to be quite honest with you, if we were in that kind of situation, I believe that one of the things we have to look at is the fact that I've acted in good faith. Now, the only question is whether you believe the statements and the motion that I filed today. Now,
no,
I understand, where you're going with this, and I do understand
good
that.
Good faith is not an issue here.
Good faith is actually a very good issue today, because I have supplied you information letting you know that she was actually hospitalized through a treating physician. Now, where that has gone or the information provided by that physician needs to be taken up with that physician. I'm here to handle her legal issue, not her medical issue, and I'm not at liberty because of HIPAA violations to let this entire court know, as well as the entire community know, exactly what the specific ailment is or the specific place where she was treated during that time.
I think that speaks to, overall, the trust gap that I think some council members and I think the community at large has, considering that Councilman Green has been, at least by the Metro Ethics Commission, found to have violated the Metro Ethics Ordinance twice, deliberately violated that law. Councilman Green is appealing that decision in Jefferson Circuit Court, obviously. But I think that's what really the council members wanted to see. A lot of their questions came down to what is wrong with her specifically and where was she hospitalized. Attorney Greg Hovius, who was prosecuting the case, he argued that this information still could be provided under seal, meaning it wouldn't be disclosed to the media or to the public, but the council members, the ones who are presiding over the case, get that information. At the end of the day, across the board, you heard different members, bipartisan members, say that this information, this affidavit, was just very vague.
Now, she hasn't been seen doing any public duties or made any public statements since.
No, she hasn't. She has not been. She wasn't at last night's Metro Council meeting. She has not been on her radio program. Also, she hasn't spoken to her attorney, Derwin Webb, in about 2 weeks. Webb admitted that in court yesterday. He hasn't spoken to Councilman Green for that period of time, but he's been really getting all this information relayed to him via Councilman Green's husband, James Green. So at this point, with the council rejecting her motion, the trial is set for September 12th. Obviously, Mr. Webb can file another motion or any other amount of motions to delay the hearing, but his problem is, and he said this after the council made this decision, is that he doesn't feel that he can adequately provide a defense for Councilman Green if she's not physically present and he can't meet with her to go over the case. Many members asked Mr. Webb if he had all the information from the police interviews and the Ethics Commission's transcripts. He said he did, and Mr. Hovius argued that Webb could still make the case using her depositions from those other cases and having other witnesses testify, and that they can still go forward. But Webb feels this can't go forward, and he can't provide an adequate defense for Councilwoman Green if she's not present, and he basically denounced the decision as unfair.
All right. Thank you very much, Philip. We'll be coming back to you. Let's turn to Erica Peterson, WFPL Environment Reporter. Now, last week at this time, Erica, we had you on the phone because you were in the coal fields of eastern Kentucky on this EPA-sponsored tour of areas affected by coal mining. What did you bring back from that? And what's I think you've heard from the a coal interest since then, haven't you?
Yes, I have. Well, one of the things that that kind of struck me while I was on the tour was that it was, I mean, you know, I think from any perspective, it was very one-sided. There were no protesters who showed up to protest the visit. There were really very few, if any, people who showed up to kind of express the more economic side of coal and its importance in the region. And since then, we have heard from the coal industry. Charles Baird, who is the president of Coal Operators and Owners, I believe, which is based in Pikeville, did send out kind of a scathing press release talking about the visit. Congressman Hal Rogers responded as well, expressing his disappointment that he wasn't notified about the visit. The EPA the whole time said this, you know, this is not a secret. They were going around to several stops, and it wasn't a secret. People in the communities really did seem to know that this was going on. Whether or not it was widely publicized, I don't know. But you know how it is in a small town. You know, people know. Yeah. People know what's going on. I did speak with Bill Bissett of the Kentucky Coal Association on Sunday, and he was notified of the meeting and was invited. The issue he had with it was that the EPA basically offered to meet with the coal industry for an hour on Friday during their last hour in Kentucky, and he kind of felt like that was A, not enough time, considering that they had spent about 2 days going around with people from the environmental community. And most of the coal industry was at a meeting in Lexington at a conference. And he said this would be a great opportunity for the EPA to come up and everyone's in one place. And they just, you know, they had a flight to catch. So they weren't able to make that trip. So
now, I think I may have asked you this last week, but is the EPA going to do anything with the information that it gathered from this trip?
They say they are. This was kind of a they build it as kind of an environmental justice and listening tour, and they did do a lot of listening. There were a couple of public statements made by Gwen Keyes Fleming, the Region 4 administrator, and Lisa Garcia, the special advisor for environmental justice. But it was mostly listening, and they were very cautious to talk about details. A lot of people wanted to hear, you know, we understand your concerns about this permit and we're going to veto it, or and of course they didn't say anything like that. But they did take pictures, they took notes. It was evident when people were speaking to them in a group setting, they would be kind of whispering back and forth about, you know, things to look at later. So we'll see if anything actually does come of it.
All right, Erica, thank you, and welcome back to the studio.
Thank you.
Talk to you again in a moment. Back to you, Gabe Bullard. You've been reporting on the job cuts announced yesterday at Jewish mm-hmm. Hospital.
Yeah, yesterday it was announced that 155 jobs would be cut. About 45 of those, 46 or so, are already vacant. People had resigned. They'll just be cut through attrition. The rest, that's layoffs that are happening. This comes a year after the parent company, Jewish Hospital and St. Mary's Healthcare, cut 500 jobs. They announced that in March, I believe. So these cuts are being made, and this is something that the hospital has not been incredibly forward talking about, as usual with any business. They haven't, you know, put a ton of people out there making comments and everything. They have put out some statements. The statement announcing these 155 jobs being cut said that this is the result of a market trend, that healthcare is changing, the business is changing, and the economy is changing. And some people who used to go into the hospital aren't going into the hospital anymore. And it's just very much a changing world. And so these cuts are necessary. It didn't say whether that was related to the merger between Jewish Hospital, University of Louisville Hospital, and Catholic Health Initiatives. Though the University of Louisville hospital people have been very open about saying this is necessary, this has to happen to keep the hospital strong, to keep the hospital well-funded, to keep the hospital going in the future. So today, a new statement was issued from Jewish Hospital saying that these cuts that are happening this week, the cuts that happened last year, are an example of why the merger is necessary, that the hospital is not necessarily... Not that it is definitely not, but it's not necessarily a sustainable model going forward. They're saying this merger has to happen to prevent future layoffs. The interesting thing about that is that there will likely be job cuts in the merger. Whenever companies merge, there's redundancies created. Mm-hmm. And when those redundancies are created, those jobs are lost. So there may be some layoffs necessary to prevent even wider spread layoffs in the future. It's a very interesting situation.
Has Jewish Hospital indicated exactly which positions are being eliminated this time around?
No, they haven't, although they do say that the nurse-to-patient ratio will not change, and they say that healthcare will not be negatively affected.
And some of these positions are vacant.
Yes. Yeah, about 45, 46. It's 30% of 155, which I think is around 45, yeah. 46.
Okay, thank you, Gabe. Let's move back over to Devin Katayama. Let's go back to Jefferson County Public Schools. You went to a meeting this week where they do their annual... set the annual tax rate, and it was raised a bit again this time.
Yeah, this was the first board meeting of the new school year. And you had some people in the crowd who weren't too happy about this raise. This raise is a tenth of a cent, which is the minimal increase possible for tax revenue increase for the school district. They're allowed up to 4% tax revenue increase. Over the past 4 years, they've been increasing the tax rates. Last year was 3 cents up from the previous year before. The previous year was 2 cents. So this is a really small increase. And Superintendent Donna Hargan says that this will not bring any additional revenue because house prices have diminished. So, and with the budget that they currently have, this is not going to be bringing them any additional revenue. That still did not stop some people from voicing their opinions. There were some members of the Tea Party, some people who were just against taxes altogether, who did not want this increase. And just so that you get some idea about what this increase is, if your house is assessed at $100,000, last year you were paying around $676. This year you would pay $677. So it's $1 more a year. But some people still weren't happy about that increase.
Now, when does this take effect? Immediately?
This will take effect for this next year. I'm not exactly sure when they'll be collecting these taxes.
And now, how does this process work? Is this are there public hearings prior to this, or is it published somewhere? Or they just take it up at a meeting?
Well, as far as I could tell at that board meeting, they were listening to the people who were speaking, which about three people spoke mm-hmm. Against this, and then they put a vote on it. So at that point, they could have voted against it, but it was grouped with a whole bunch of other things that they were deciding on. So they just decided right then to go ahead and go through with this.
All right, Devin, thank you. Back over to Philip M. Bailey. Philip, Kentucky's Capitol Hill delegation, of course, home from Washington this month. Many turned out yesterday for the big Farm Bureau ham breakfast at the Kentucky State Fair, which we both attended as well and covered. Usually the speeches are kind of devoted to farm policy, but that wasn't the case with Senator Rand Paul, who had some interesting remarks.
Yes, Senator Paul, I think, is probably one of the more fascinating political characters in the country. Depending on what interview you listen to, Senator Paul's perspective and your perspective of him could be radically different. Obviously, people remember his infamous interview with Rachel Maddow last year, in which he sort of indicated that he would not have voted for the Civil Rights Act or Voting Rights Act back in the 1960s. But in this speech before the Kentucky Farm Bureau, before the ham breakfast, Senator Paul, I think, defied what a lot of critics say was the intransigency of the Tea Party. Senator Paul obviously is the face of the Tea Party in many ways. He actually argued for compromise, saying that there was room for it in the debt ceiling negotiations now that the 12-member supercommittee has been formed, saying that there is compromise between Republicans and Democrats, that they might not necessarily sing kumbaya together, but that they do see some areas of compromise, specifically Democrats wanting to increase taxes on the wealthy. Senator Paul says instead of doing that as far as taxes on the front end, there's some loopholes that can be closed on the benefit side, saying that Republicans would be willing to raise benefits for the wealthy, whether for their Social Security benefits or for Medicare, and saying that could be a room to raise revenue to help cut the deficit. The 12-member supercommittee obviously is being charged with cutting $1.5 trillion over the next 10 years. If they are able to come to an agreement, that will go for an up or down vote in the Congress. Sometime, I think, before the deadline for that is December 23rd. Other members of Congress in our Kentucky delegation have obviously shown some skepticism to that. Congressman John Yarmuth, who Gabe interviewed earlier this week, he's indicated, and he was also at the ham breakfast, he indicated that he's not very confident that committee can come to a compromise and get things together, and that there will be across-the-board triggers that will cut defense and domestic spending as a result.
Now, you and Erica, I'll turn this question to you. Coal has always been a big issue in the races for state office in Kentucky, and Phillip's been covering the race for attorney general. And Republican Todd Peeple, the GOP nominee, had some remarks about mine inspections this week.
He did. I don't know, Phillip, this might be a better question for you, but I was surprised at Fancy Farm when Peeple didn't mention coal really at all in his speech. He is from Western Kentucky, and there are coal mines in Western Kentucky. And Jack Conway did mention his lawsuit against the EPA that he was taking on behalf of the governor. But this week, Todd Peeple said in an interview with CN2 Pure Politics, he was basically talking about growing up in Western Kentucky, and he talked about how he feels like the unions, the United Mine Workers of America and other mine unions, are kind of unnecessary now because the mines are so, well regulated and inspected by the government. So he said it's gone too far. But then he also said that the government regulation and inspection of mines has also gone too far. So I mean, personally, that made me a little bit confused about what he thinks needs to be done in terms of coal mine inspections.
Yeah, I think with the Attorney General's race, I think Mr. Peeples' attempt to nationalize the race, bringing attention not only to the president's health care law, but also with issues with the coal industry, I think it's really just to find any weaknesses in Conway's base, particularly amongst those who are supportive of the coal industry in rural parts of the state. I think that, that attempt, the Conway campaign at least has said that that attempt to nationalize the race, that if Mr. Peeple wants to make these issues relevant, he should run for U.S. Senate. And that's what the Attorney General said at yesterday's ham breakfast. It is interesting that people did not make that attempt, at least at Fancy Farm, but certainly in any, I think, conversation that people has had with the media, he mentions three things: Obama, healthcare, coal. I mean, those are the and sometimes he'll even add in Aquabuda, mentioning the Attorney General Conway ran against now Senator Rand Paul back for the U.S. Senate race. So it's a mix and match here, I think, for people, and particularly because I think for Republicans, as I think I've mentioned before, as Senator Williams is trailing Governor Beshear by 24 points in the polls, a lot of Republicans are looking at the Attorney General's race as sort of the silver lining of these statewide elections. It gives not only Republicans a connection to federal issues, but it gives them, I think, a check and a balance on a lot of the democratically held statewide offices.
You're listening to State of the News on WFPL. We're talking to the WFPL news team covering our Metro News this week. Coming up shortly, we're going to talk to a couple of tech writers about this week's big announcement from Steve Jobs that he's resigning as CEO of Apple. And then we're going back to the state fair one more time. Gabe Bullard's going to take us back this time. He made a visit to the beer tent and met what I assume are some interesting people.
Very interesting, yeah.
Let's go back to you for a moment, Gabe, but we talked about the job cuts at Jewish Hospital. Anything new with this this merger that we've been talking about? Are the players going back to Frankfurt for another round of testimony?
Yeah, well, possibly. Last week, there was a joint committee on healthcare or health and resources. I forget the exact name of it. They called the principals before their committee in Frankfurt to discuss the merger. There are a number of members of the Louisville delegation on that committee, and they had a number of questions for U of L President Ramsey and the officials with Catholic Health Initiatives about, and the officials with Jewish Hospital, about what will happen to reproductive services, what will happen to end-of-life care. They were again assured that there may be another facility somewhere that will provide a lot of these services, that they could move a lot of services for women, cesarean sections, tubal ligations, things like that that would require surgery, to another facility. They couldn't say where that facility would be. Representative Tom Birch of Louisville confirmed that U of L is looking into finding another facility, possibly through another healthcare provider, to provide tubal ligations for women. I talked with Representative Birch after the meeting, talked to him on the phone for a while, and he said he's not entirely satisfied with the answers. There's a lot that's still up in the air, and others have criticized U of L for announcing this too soon, for announcing the merger before all these details could really be worked out, saying that maybe they rushed into saying how great it was going to be without necessarily saying how it would work. So Tom Birch expects to have everyone back to Frankfurt sometime, probably in January or so. He is sending a letter over to U of L asking for some information. He wants a few different things. He wants some clarifications on questions that he and his constituents have. But then he also wants to know the religion of all of the members of the management boards who will run this merged entity. That question drew some criticism because it was odd for someone in state government to request the religions for what would ostensibly be a private organization, though there is some dispute over whether University Hospital is private or public. He said it's okay to ask for the religions. They would have to volunteer that information, of course, but he says legislators volunteer their religion all the time. He said he's Catholic. You can go to his website. It says he's Catholic. A number of other legislators, if you go to the Legislative Research Commission website, it says their religion on there. So he says, essentially, why can't U of L provide the same information if board members would volunteer it? The reason why he says that's important is that religion might govern their actions in running this merge facility. There is a lot of concern that because these Catholic health directives can change, because the Vatican leadership could change, the Pope can change, bishops can change, that the situation in the merger will change, that the rules of the hospital might change. And we're starting to see now some of the opposition to this merger, not necessarily opposition, but opposition to losing these services, want to secure some sort of insulation between the changing times and the services offered.
We still don't have a final date on when this merger might be official, right?
No, it still would have to clear regulatory approval from the state and the federal government, and this final deal still has to be worked out, too.
All right, Philip, let's wrap up with a couple of election notes from you. There were some new accusations coming out today in the Williams-Bashir campaign.
Yes, what's happened, and this was a story that broke this morning, it was found that an attorney with the Kentucky Department of Education advised school officials in Bell County, which is a southeastern part of the state, advised them against to cease immediately prayers before athletic events, public prayers before athletic events. Senator Williams pounced on that issue, calling on Governor Bashir to denounce what he calls, quote, an attack on prayer. He cites a number of other incidents, particularly with Governor Bashir when he was attorney general, being against the Ten Commandments, I guess, being posted outside of courthouses, and also the governor's, quote, war on Christmas. Back in 2009, obviously people might remember, Governor Bashir named the giant evergreen the holiday tree instead of the Christmas tree. Many social conservatives felt that that was Governor Bashir waging a war on Christians and war on Christmas. So the governor's office, we contacted them. They responded by saying that, swatting away at Williams' call by saying that the Kentucky Department of Education doesn't answer to the governor, that it answers to the commissioner of education, and that the advice was given after Bell County officials sort of figured out that it was going to be a long legal battle, that the practice is unconstitutional. So, you know, Senator Williams has been courting social conservatives for a while. I mean, not only on the issue of gaming, but issues like abortion and everything else, and trailing as much as he does in the polls. It's not that surprising that he's gone after Governor Bashir and tried to highlight this issue to raise and generate some attention to the race.
Speaking of polls, there's a third candidate in this race, Gatewood Galbraith, and he claims that there is a poll that shows him in second place.
Yes, independent Gatewood Galbraith, Lexington attorney, who's a perennial candidate, who says he's a perennial candidate because there are perennial problems in the state. I believe he's run for governor at least four times before. Certainly a popular figure out in the state. Certainly, I think he hit a home run at Fancy Farm with his speech down there a few weeks ago. But he was on Alex Jones, a conspiracy theorist. He was on his radio program recently. And in that during that program, Galbraith claimed that there was a poll showing him gaining ground on Senator Williams. Alex Jones then repeated that line, saying that Galbraith had overtaken Senator Williams in a poll, and Galbraith agreed with him later on, saying that, you know, now we're in second place. We're not clear what poll that is. Since the general election started, there have been two polls, the Bluegrass poll showing Galbraith at about 9%, and with Senator Williams at, I believe, 28%. So we're not sure. We've tried to contact the Galbraith campaign to find out what poll that they are actually citing that shows him in second place. But to, at this point, it is an unknown poll that Mr. Galbraith was citing on Alex Jones's radio program.
All right, we'll make that the last word in our Metro News coverage. Thanks to the WFPL News team, Philip Bailey, Gabe Bullard, Erica Peterson, and Devin Katayama. Great work, everyone.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Still ahead, we'll talk with Jason Snell of Macworld Magazine and Pete Paschal of PC Mag about this week's resignation of Apple CEO Steve Jobs. That's coming up after the break. This is State of the News on WFPL. Welcome back to State of the News. I'm Rick Hallett, and we, of course, encourage your participation in the program as we talk about news events from this week. Our number is 502-814-TALK, 502-814-8255, or toll-free 1-877-814-TALK. That's 877-814-8255. You can email us at news at WFPL.org. We're on Twitter at WFPL News and also on Facebook. I have always said that if there ever came a day when I could no longer meet my duties and expectations as Apple's CEO, I would be the first to let you know. And that's exactly what Steve Jobs did this week, stepping down as the leader of the technology giant. Jobs, of course, has been battling cancer. He strongly recommended that he be succeeded by Chief Operating Officer Tim Cook. Joining us now to talk about Steve Jobs' legacy at Apple and what's ahead at the company are Jason Snell, editor of Macworld Magazine and host of the podcast The Incomparable, and Pete Paschal, news director of PC Mag. Gentlemen, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
No problem.
Right, welcome to the program. Thanks. Jason, let's start with the resignation of Jobs itself. What do we know now about Jobs' health? Obviously, it's a serious situation.
Well, they've been keeping it very private, so we don't really know, other than the fact that he has taken three leaves of absence for health reasons, the most recent one in January. The previous leave, Tim Cook was actually named acting CEO during that period, so we've sort of been down this path for a while now, it's been, I think, 6 years that they've known that Steve Jobs has had some serious health problems, but they haven't gone into detail. The last, I think, we heard about it was that when it came out that he had had a liver transplant, but that was several years ago, and they've given no details since then. You know, he's still quite thin. There was a good report in the Wall Street Journal that said that sources close to Apple said that his health is up and down, and sometimes he's at home and sometimes he's at work, but he's still engaged as much as he can be in Apple. I think the letter this week was really saying that he can't be engaged at the level that a company like Apple needs for its CEO.
Now, will he serve on the Apple board?
He's been named as the chairman of the board, in fact, which I was surprised to discover he wasn't already, but he is now on the board as the chairman of the board, and Tim Cook is now both on the board as a member and the CEO.
I think that move indicates a little bit that he's not quite on his deathbed just yet. I would think that if it were a matter of days or weeks at this point, that he would just have said goodbye. So I think the chairman move and the reports that he does want to stay actively involved, at least in sort of a design and product sense for the next little while, might indicate he still has a little bit of time left.
Yeah, I agree. It's definitely Apple sending a message that he's not stepping away from the company. He's just taking a step back. And it seems to me, my gut is that the same, which is that they wouldn't have gone through the trouble of making him the chairman if they felt like it was a very short period of time left in his life. So I think it certainly sends that message that he's still around, he's still involved, he's just not going to be the CEO.
Pete, what's been the reaction in Silicon Valley and the tech world? You know, it was kind of expected, I guess, but I still sense there was a little shock this week when the announcement came out.
It was definitely a shock. It definitely caught the tech press flat-footed, at least on the East Coast, in terms of the time of day, because we had just finished for the day. I think the reaction is one of sort of cautious optimism for the company and that it will continue to innovate and do well. Obviously, product life cycles as they are and then planning cycles, the next couple years of the major moves of what Apple is going to be doing is pretty much already laid out, at least internally. So, and Tim Cook obviously has had the role of CEO in function for quite some time. And everyone seems to think highly of him. Virtually every analyst quote I saw on him that he's the man for the job. And the fact that Apple had a succession plan in place was really the thing people were worried about, and that they clearly had one. Everything's, you know, going to be okay. So I think, you know, generally the reaction is positive, cautious. You know, the fact that Steve Jobs is taking this step back, and he was such a synonymous with the company, you know, it gives some pause. But you know, he's going to be involved going forward, so it's not a super shock.
Jason, you wrote an interesting piece about Jobs leaving the company back in the 80s, after which it proceeded kind of to take a dive, but you're quick to point out that this is a different time and a different Apple company.
Right. Apple in the 80s, first off, wasn't really Steve Jobs' company. He was the co-founder of it, but he did not have complete control over the company or the board, which is why John Sculley, who was the CEO that Jobs recruited, ended up basically engineering his ouster. It was a company that Jobs had he was participating in the Mac project, which led to the launch of the Mac in 1984, but it wasn't a company built in his image at all. And then when he left, people say, well, last time he left, look what happened to Apple. That actually was a process. At the death of Apple after Steve Jobs left, that's a 13-year span in there. People seem to think, kind of compress it down to a couple of years, but it was from 1985 until 1997 when Apple was really at death's door and Steve Jobs came back. So even then, it took a long time and three different CEOs before Apple got to that point of desperation and when Steve Jobs came back. This time, you know, Jobs has been back there for 14 years. He has built this company in his image now. He's had complete control. He learned his lesson from the last time. He has had complete control of the company. The executives there are ones he picked and he worked with and know his philosophy. And then more to the point, not only has he had 14 years to really create this corporate culture in his image, it's his culture, but for the last 5 or 6 years, there's been an awareness of Steve Jobs' mortality and his inability potentially to be there for the long term. I mean, his initial diagnosis was that he would only have a few weeks to live. And then it turned out that later that day, they discovered it was a slower growing kind of tumor. But, you know, he said in a commencement address at Stanford University that, you know, it gave him a completely different perspective. And the fact that they set up this thing called Apple University, which is trying to detail the processes that Apple uses internally when it's building products, it's basically trying to create a course of Apple culture, like a college course of Apple's culture to teach future employees. It speaks to me that over the last 6 years, Apple's invested a lot of time on the problem of what happens when Steve is gone. So they're as prepared as a company can be for something like this. It's not to say that there aren't going to be trials, but they seem to have done a really good job of preparing and are in a much better place than the last time Steve Jobs left Apple, where it was a very different environment.
All right. Jason Snell is editor of...
Apple approach to products would be something fairly difficult, though, because what resonated with me and what you were talking about is the complete control paradigm, which comes down, like, not just in terms of how Jobs has been running the company, but how Apple treats its entire product line. So to have, you know, to say to other companies, you need to have, like, total control, I mean, whether that's part of the course or not, it would be a very difficult thing to do. But, you know, there is no question Apple has been very successful doing it.
All right, I'm going to have to stop you guys there. Thanks for joining us. Jason Snell is editor of Macworld Magazine and the host of the podcast The Incomparable. Pete Pascal is news director of PC Mag. Gentlemen, thanks again for joining us.
Thanks.
Happy to be here.
We'll be back with more in a moment. This is State of the News on WFPL. Welcome back to State of the News. I'm Rick Howlett. It's Friday night and the State Fair is in town. For many people, that means one thing, beer tent. This weekend, thousands of people will flock to the fairgrounds to drink $6 beers, sit in the shade, and listen to cover bands. But why would fairgoers deal with high prices, heat, and frustrating parking instead of going to their neighborhood bar? WFPL's Gabe Bullard went to the fair to find out, and we should point out this report contains some coarse language.
See, ain't that sweet? You know this is going to be on Facebook, don't you?
First beer.
Every year for the last 15 years.
We did that last night.
I've been every year. Every 16 years now.
We go to the beer tents, the rides, the exhibits.
We're exhibitors.
35 years.
At least 40 years.
Year after year?
Yes.
We've been out here since 4.
Doing it for a long time.
But see, I just turned 21.
After a certain age, yes, when you can see the beer tent, yes. That's you people watch right here.
We come out here and have breakfast and people watch. We just look. We're just sitting here.
Breakfast at the fair.
We come here for photo opportunities.
Things that you don't see every day.
It's pretty much outrageous.
I mean, it's the craziest thing in the state. It's the best day of the year.
It's a show. The people are a show.
He's got a Jamaican banana.
We're trying to be nice here.
This drunk lady in there with her shorts way too high.
I've been talking to a lot of chicks, and one or two of them been getting on my nerves, but the rest of the time has been wonderful.
For some reason, I get older, but the girls are younger and hotter.
So. The girl wants to know what you're doing.
Seeing what they're doing.
I got a room for two nights.
Because I see this dude with this long hair up on stage. He's rocking.
Real loud.
Can't hear him over the music.
Normally on a Friday night, I would work all day and then whatever. It's about whatever.
Probably in the sweatpants on the couch watching a movie, being lame. It's Friday.
Staying at home, probably.
Staying at home, partying.
Watching Netflix. Office reruns.
Watching Dexter?
Watching TV, a scary movie probably.
We would have movie night at home with our 10-year-old son.
Shocked up with my girlfriend.
But not tonight. Because mom's at the fair.
I'm a homebody, but when things events come on, I have to come and join them. So this is one that you cannot miss.
The
Smoking weed.
Babysitting.
Working. Unfortunately.
On Friday? Like working. Yeah. Working or studying if I'm when I'm school.
Really? Not much of it. Oh man, I feel sad. Nothing much.
Say something really.
Not
bad.
Much of
it. At the lake. Drinking beer.
Bud Light, ain't it?
Miller Light. It's cool, it's light, it's hot out here.
Lord, yes. That's all I got in my refrigerator and my car. I'm parking lot. No, I'm just teasing.
Yeah, we do drink Bud Light when we come over here.
Budweiser.
The Miller Tent actually has different beers than the Bud Tent. It's not all Bud Light.
It's not just beer, it's food. This is the gateway to the food, too.
We got fried chicken tenders, chicken wings.
Food.
French fries, all fried food, onion rings.
Everything.
They also ran out of donuts for the donut burgers.
I'm not with them.
Food's high.
Prices?
It's not went up a whole lot, but it's went up every year.
Prices going up, but wages don't go up, so, yeah.
Inflation. You know, I mean, everything goes up.
We all hate the parking.
Basically, it sucks.
It's gotten higher.
That's crazy. I don't care what year it is. Yeah, that's crazy.
Is it worth it?
Yes.
Oh, yes.
Definitely.
That's all the time we have for today's program. State of the News is produced by the WFPL News staff. I'm Rick Halbert. Have a good weekend.